Made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with 2004-2005 season musical performances by jazz greats Herbie Hancock, Michael Brecker, and Roy Hargrove, pianists Ivo Pugarelic and Richard Good, singers Nathan Gunn and Don Upshaw, and the Chicago and Prague Symphony Orchestras. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from Russia, South America, Mexico, and Britain, and featuring food tastings every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, we'll glimpse the world of children by talking with an ethnographer who has immersed himself into the culture of children for 30 years. He has observed children in various settings in the U.S. and in Italy. In the course of his research, he's followed several groups of children as they moved from preschool to elementary schools. Our guest is Indiana University sociologist William Corsaro. He is the author of We're Friends, Right? Inside Kids' Culture. Professor Corsaro says children can tell us a great deal about how we can, in his words, help them preserve and enrich their childhoods, as well as prepare them for the adult world. He also says he wants to share the stories of children because, quoting again, they are important in their own right. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Corsaro's research has been featured on NPR, on the BBC, and in The New Yorker. We're Friends, Right? Inside Kids' Culture is published by the Joseph Henry Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the phone numbers. Give us a call. Join the conversation. Professor Corsaro, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
Are there many people like you who are listening to what kids have to say about being a kid?
I think more and more. I think early on, when I first started my research 30 years ago, the field was dominated by developmental psychologists who were more interested in children's individual development as opposed to children's cultures. And I myself started out thinking that children were more active and contributed to their own development in their interaction with peers. But once I got in there studying children, I was surprised to find they had their own peer cultures, which we need to appreciate and learn more about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that just for a little bit in terms of these words that we're going to use this afternoon. Culture of children, peer cultures. What does that mean?
Yeah, by peer culture, I mean I've sort of looked at it as children's activities, routines, artifacts, values, and concerns that children produce and share together in interaction with each other. The idea of routines are things that they do on an everyday basis that they often create on their own and that have meaning to them. They're artifacts. When I say artifacts, I'm thinking of children's drawings and other kinds of productions, things they may make with different kinds of building materials and toys and so on, that also have important meaning to them, both in the constructions of these materials and also what they communicate about their lives.
Yeah. Well, give us an idea, an example of what you mean by this idea of routine.
Yes, they engage in a lot of different kinds of routines that are repetitive and that occur again and again in their lives. One kind of routine that I think a lot of people are familiar with if they watch children is role play, where they take on the roles of adults or other things that exist in society, where they may become a mother or a father and then engage in a role play routine in the family or an occupational role. like a firefighter, et cetera. And in taking on these roles, they really kind of appropriate the information from the adult world rather than merely imitate it. And then they explore what that adult world is like and what it'll be like when they're adults. And at the same time, they embellish the play and do things that are fun for them. And it's a routine in the sense that it happens again and again. Another kind of routine I found that children engage in a lot is what I call kind of approach avoidance play.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a kind of play where they will label another child or maybe even an adult or maybe even something that a stationary object as something that's threatening. And then they slowly approach it, get very close to it, and then they'll run away and act afraid and oftentimes will run to a safe base. And maybe the child who is taking on the threatening role will chase after them, but when they get to this home base, will move away again. And this is often repeated. I see this a lot in the play of 3- and 4-year-olds. And later, I think it becomes the kind of the basis for games with rules that have this kind of underlying feature of approach and avoidance.
Yeah.
And it makes children, it gives children a sense of security of dealing with things that they may be afraid of or curious about, but in this game, they're in control. They decide who to define as a threatening agent and what's home base and whether they'll approach or not and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And in my work, I've been able to both observe this and videotape this kind of play and found it again and again both in the United States and in Italy and there's other work in other countries that show that this kind of routine exists.
Yeah, that's a really interesting routine, this approach avoidance routine. It's a way of practicing what do we do if, but it also offers drama.
Right, exactly. It offers drama and excitement and security at the same time.
Yeah.
And again, I think as adults, if you kind of watch kids doing this, it looks like they're just running around at first, you know. But then if you see how well it's coordinated and you see them building the drama, often through embellishments, they'll sometimes taunt the threatening agent, saying, you can't get us, and so on. And so they build up this drama, and at the same time, they are a little bit afraid, but they also know that they have security in the way the routine is structured.
Yeah. Is that part of the games of hide and seek and tag?
Yeah, I think it's precursors to that. I think at 3- and 4-year-old children, this is just done spontaneously. They seem to know how to do it. They don't talk about it as a game. When children are a little older, 6 and so, it may be a formal game. In Italy, it was a formal game in which there was a witch, and you approached the witch, and she covered her eyes, and then when you got close to her, she named a color, and then you had to go and find the color before she caught you, which is a very good, very similar kind of game to hide and seek and freeze tag and some other kinds of games with rules that appear more among older children.
Yeah. I can remember growing up, my brothers and I playing something like this in terms of there's a monster under the bed, but
yeah,
if you get to this point in the room, you're safe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, we developed some pretty intricate, almost dance steps to get to, you know, well, you have to walk this way and...
Exactly.
You know.
Once you have the basic structure, then you can begin to play and embellish it. And
This
is another feature, kind of more general feature of peer culture, I think there are two, and that's one, that children want to do things together. They want to participate and play together. And they want to feel like they have control over their lives. And these routines give them both of those features. They're doing something together, but they are in control of the play. It's their play. They created it. And again, in this case, they create the drama and a little bit of insecurity, but at the same time, the game itself has this built-in way of protecting them.
Yeah. This is a really important idea. I want to emphasize it. You state in the book, kids want to gain control of their lives and share that sense of control with each other.
Yes, I see that again and again. And you know, in some contexts, it can even be misinterpreted. For example, for, again, the younger children, and this, the younger age group is the one where I think I learned the most from, although you know, more recently I've been working with a little bit older children. But the 3s and 4s, when they first in preschools, and I work basically in preschool settings, have to learn they begin to engage in interaction with others, and they find that the interaction is often very fragile. They kind of have to work together to get something going. And oftentimes, once they do that, they'll kind of look at each other, and this is where the name of my book came from.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, we're friends, right? Because we're doing something together, we're friends. But then they immediately become very protective of that play because they know that it could be easily disrupted because they work so hard to get it going. Maybe another kid will come in and won't know exactly what they're doing, or a teacher will enter the play or say it's cleanup time or whatever. So they have this tendency to protect the interactive space. So if another child comes over and just asks, can I play, they're often told, no, you can't play. And they may even say, you're not our friend. Now, on the surface, that looks like they're not sharing. It's not a good thing. But if you look at it from their point of view, what they want to do is keep sharing what they're already sharing, and they're afraid that the other child might disrupt that. And what happens is that kids that approach and want to get into the play develop very complex access strategies. They watch. They might even kind of circle around. They figure out what the other kids are doing, and then they go in and do something similar. And then they're accepted because they show that they know what the play is and that they can participate without disrupting it. And that's interesting because it's very similar to what we do in similar kinds of situations where we're in a situation where there are a number of small groups. If we're at a party, we just, and people are talking, we just don't go up and say, you know, what are you talking about? Can I talk? You know, we stand by and listen, figure out what the conversation's about and make a contribution. And that's what these kids are learning with these access strategies. So again, something that on the surface from an adult point of view first kind of looks like kids are not sharing and being selfish and saying mean things turns out to be a lot more complex than it looks, and it shows again this desire to participate and keep control over their shared participation.
What should teachers and parents and other adults do in this situation when they're concerned the kids aren't letting someone into the game? And
I think that we should not intervene so quickly, that we should see if kids can work it out on their own. And as I've said, that's what I found, that they come up with these access strategies and they can. If a child comes and says they won't let me play, or you know, they said they're not my friend, we should say, well, what are they playing? Let's sit and watch and look and see what they're doing. And then actually do that with the child, and then suggest, do you think you can do that? Go in and, you know, go over now and see if you can do something like they're doing. And this would help them be successful in gaining entry. I think to immediately intervene can actually, and it often did, I found, disrupt the play, and then the children decide not to continue playing and go off and do something else and so on. Certainly, we don't want to, if the same child is being rejected again and again, we want to help them develop the skills to get in, and we don't want to allow children to bully other children. But we need to look at the situation and see exactly what's going on and I think react accordingly.
Mm. Vivian Paley is another person who's done a lot of observation of children. She's a kindergarten teacher. I don't know if she's still teaching. But she has a rule in her classroom, you can't say you can't play.
Right, and I have a kind of a different reaction to this. Now, one important thing is that she's talking a little bit about older children. She's talking about six-year-olds,
right.
And I was talking earlier mainly about
three- and four-year-olds.
I think with six-year-olds, you might run into the fact that there are certain children who are being rejected, who either lack the skills or are being picked on for certain reasons, and I can understand her rule in that regard. Although I would often caution that rule a little bit because it kind of says that the individual is more important to the group, that the group should accommodate to the individual. And in society, that's not the way things work. I mean, we as individuals have to learn to be part of a group and participate in a group. So although I think I understand why she used that rule in her school, even if you read her book, she says that the children didn't always agree with it.
Right.
and said, well, you know, we say this because we've got this good play going. This person isn't always as good at it and so on and so forth. And so I think we have to think about rules that put too much emphasis on the individual, because we're sending that, we may be sending the wrong message in terms of what children have to learn to get along with socially the group and be a part of a group. So I have kind of mixed reactions, but clearly I agree with her that we don't want to allow certain children to be continually rejected, because that certainly can have negative effects on them, not only in their childhood, but possibly later in life.
Yeah, we have a listener waiting to talk with us on a cell phone on line one. Let's go and talk with this listener. Good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Hope you can hear me. Actually, I had an observation and a quick question, and I'll hang up and listen. I've got a 3-year-old daughter at home and a 9-year-old, and I was just curious as to your observation with children, where they fall into the scheme of things as far as youngest to oldest. What I observed is my 3-year-old can completely immerse herself by herself in her play, be it whether dolls or just complete imagination. But once she senses that she's being observed by an adult, it just stops immediately. It's like you enter this forbidden world and the play gets turned off, and that's the end of it. But my 9-year-old, the oldest, seems incapable of being able to play by herself. In other words, mommy and daddy have to play with her, but it seems like she can't imagine that, you know, imagination world. And the reason I bring this up is both my wife.
Well, I think we lost the
signal. That was a great. I hope you can still hear us. It was a great question. And a great observation. First, in terms of the 3-year-old, the 3 and 4-year-olds I find often engage in this fantasy play when they're together, and they also do it when they're alone. In the case of his daughter, but I would imagine if his daughter were in a preschool with 3 or 4-year-olds, you would see the same kind of fantasy play that's very improvised, very creative, that doesn't have, you know, a set of rules. You never know where they're going. When children would do this, they would often do it in around sand tables or moving little toy animals or whatever. And I would have my little animal, but they would always be about 4 steps ahead of me in creating a play theme. And many of these themes involve things like danger and then rescue, lost and found, death and rebirth. But it would be very improvised and highly creative. And the fact that he mentioned this about the 9-year-old is interesting, because I have a kind of theory that we kind of lose this ability of improvisation this kind of fantasy way as we get older. As children begin to play games with rules, they begin to form friendships and evaluate those friendships and so on. The fantasy play kind of goes more by the wayside, and they want to plan things out, and they want things to be more organized. And I think that's unfortunate, but it's also a sign that we don't really, I think, have enough appreciation of this fantasy play among young children. And I think as adults, sometimes we, you know, he said his daughter wouldn't let him do it, but I find kids will kind of let me in if I kind of just play along and follow their lead and don't try to direct it in any way. But they got used to me sitting there, so they would sort of include me in. But often I was very peripheral in the play, mainly because I wasn't good enough at it. And you know, and another thing is that we don't appreciate this so much. Again, it kind of just looks like kids playing. It was clear this caller appreciated it as a parent. But often we don't appreciate it. But when we see adults doing this kind of improvisation, you know, we pay them. People like Robin Williams we think is fantastic.
Right.
But I find young kids doing things that are really just as impressive as that in terms of improvisational skills as improvisational comedians. And it's something that I think we need to appreciate more and value in our children. And it is a shame that it kind of gets lost. And I think that's what happens with a 9-year-old. And so with the 2 children, he's got, you know, 2 different kinds of demands in terms of trying to be part of their worlds.
Yeah. Well, also as we go along, doesn't our interest in others grow? I'm thinking, like, in terms of, you know, it's summertime now, and if you go to the pool, mm-hmm. there are kids jumping off the side and saying, "Mom, Dad, look at me."
Right.
And they want to be observed, and they want to be congratulated on their accomplishments. I don't know that a three-year-old is quite there yet.
No, I would disagree with you a little
okay.
bit there. I think that in some research, even for younger children and three-year-olds, that even kids as young as two, in research in the family, develop this notion of wanting to be a participant. And one way they can be a participant is get the attention of adults. So often in one study in families, they found that children would do things they weren't supposed to do, like climb up on chairs and other sorts of things, and then call for attention and say, "Look at me, look what I'm doing," because it then gave them attention and felt and made them feel that they were a participant. So I think that starts quite early. I think the thing that's different for older kids, especially in their relationships with peers, is that they begin to have a reflective awareness of who their friends are and begin to be concerned about who likes them and who may not like them and so on. And for 3 and 4 years olds, there's less reflection. So they may have one child they play with one day and another the next. And as long as there's somebody playing with them, they're not concerned about how they feel they're being evaluated or how they might be fitting in. And so with this differentiation with older kids, they need the attention, they need the assurance that someone's their friend, that someone shares with them the same interests and so on. And to be truthful, the peer culture begins to be a little more not only more complicated, but a little more emotionally demanding when kids get to be 8, 9, and 10.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, William Corsaro. We're talking with him about children, the culture of children. He is the author of We're Friends, Right? Inside Kids Culture. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join us with questions, comments. Give us a telephone call. Join the discussion. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, how do you, as a grown-up, step outside yourself and enter the world of children and win their acceptance?
Yeah, I think, you know, this was something I developed over time. In my first study, a long time ago in Berkeley, California, I had the fortunate circumstances of getting good advice from the teachers because I got there early, and one of the teacher told me, you know, before you come right into the school, she understood, I explained to her what ethnography was and what I wanted to do and so on. But she said, before you come in, the kids the first few weeks are a little anxious, the parents are a little anxious, there's a lot going on. Why don't you kind of watch what's going on? Because they had an observation area that was used by the parents that was kind of concealed. It was a two-way kind of screen. And it was used by parents and some people that were doing observational research. And so she suggested that I start off by staying back there for a while. And I did that, and I learned a lot of things. I learned all the kids' names and a little bit about their personalities. I learned the daily routines. I learned, you know, when they were together in terms of free play and what kinds of things they did. And I also learned something very important, and that was how adults usually interacted with children, what their interactive style was. And it's basically an active style. Teachers and parents and other adults will often go up to children and initiate conversations or tell them what they can or can't do. And they'll often be looking down at children, you know, rather than getting down at their level. Teachers sometimes will get down and sit on the floor, but most adults won't. So they use an active kind of strategy. And so after watching for about a month or 5 weeks, when I went in, I just went in and sat down in areas where I knew the kids were playing certain things, and I waited and let them react to me. And at first, they didn't react much. They just kind of smiled at me and so on. And I kind of wondered about this strategy and got a little nervous. I wanted to I kept wanting to say, like, be careful, because it looked like they were going to hurt each other in different ways. But I didn't say anything. And then one day, I was playing with some kids, and they were doing some things with digging with shovels and so on. And I noticed a little girl watching me from a distance. And then these kids stopped playing, and when I looked back, she wasn't there anymore. And then she kind of tapped me on the shoulder. She had come up behind me. And she said, who are you? And I said, I'm Bill, and you're Sarah. And she said, how do you know my name? And I told her, I said, I know you're Sarah because I heard some other kids call you that. And that's, of course, how I figured it out. And she then again said, how do you know my name? So then I named some particular kids that had played with her. And then she ran in the school, and I thought, oh boy, you know, I finally got a little girl to talk to me, and I scared her away. But she came right back out with another boy, Kevin, and he ran up to me and said, what's my name? And I said, Kevin. And he then asked me to name a whole bunch of other kids. And then eventually Sarah said, well, you know, Bill knows he knows magic. And Kevin said, okay, what's my little sister's name? And the thing is, I actually even knew his little sister's name, because I had a roster of all the kids with their siblings and parents and so on. And when I told him that, he was real impressed. And then they invited some other kids over, and we began to shovel and dig. And that was sort of how I first got accepted. That was kind of what broke the ice with that group. Here was this guy who was sort of different. And then I would always, again, be in this reactive kind of situation and let them draw me into their play and kind of stay on the peripheral. I never initiated play. I never told them what to do. And over time, I never got over the size thing. A lot of the kids kind of referred to me as Big Bill, who was this big friend who came to school to play with them, and who was different from adult. And they would do things in front of me that they would not do with the teachers. And then they also knew that I couldn't help them out when there were, you know, when there was a dispute or something. They knew that they needed to go to the teachers, that they couldn't rely on me to settle things. Then when I went to Italy, things were a lot easier, because my Italian at first wasn't the best, and when I first started talking to the kids, they just thought this was so funny that this person couldn't speak Italian well, that this adult couldn't speak the language as well as they could. And so over there, I was this incompetent adult, and I was sort of, you know, Big Dumb Bill, and then they realized that I could speak better with them than the teachers, which was true, because I was used to kids, and they talked about what they did, and they adjusted their speech better. And this gave them a sense of control. They went home and told their parents, well, we have this American guy, Bill, at the school, and we can talk to him, and the teachers can't. and in every setting I've worked in, I've used this reactive method, and there have been situations where the kids identify me as somebody that, you know, is not a teacher, that is an adult, but is not going to have control over them, and wants to be their friend. And so I've been successful using that sort of method and being brought into their worlds as much as possible, but always somewhat on the periphery. Again, I play along when I'm brought into things, but I don't try to direct their play in any way.
Yeah. I love the Italian story that you tell in the book. The children were asked to describe various people in their environment, and this
right.
is how they described you. Bill is a tall young man. He has black hair, brown eyes, and wears glasses. He has a beard. He always comes to school and plays with the kids. He's good. Bill is American and not Italian. He understands the language. With the kids, he speaks Italian very well.
Yeah, that their description documented that process that I just described, this importance of being around, playing with them, wanting to be one of them, but also having this special relationship with the language, that they could, that I speak the language better with them. And in a way, they saw themselves as kind of teachers of me.
Right.
And again, it gave them this kind of sense of control over the teachers, because of the special relationship having that. And in many ways, it was true, of course. I mean, there's another story I tell where the children were playing, and it was some race cars, and they were talking. This one boy was talking very fast, like he was announcing a Grand Prix race, and And then he threw one of his cars against the wall and said, Lui è morto, which means he's dead. I knew that. And then I said something very quickly. I was usually figured out something to say when it was already too late and we'd gone on in the conversation. But this time I remembered this phrase from my courses in Italian, che peccato, which means literally what a sinner, what a pity. And I said that right away. As soon as he said Lui è morto, I said che peccato. And he looked up at me amazed, and he said, Bill's right. Bravo, Bill. And the other boy said, yeah, bravo, Bill. And then they went over and got some other kids and retold the whole story, and all the kids clapped, you know. And it was funny, but I really felt good, like I'm finally in the group. I'm finally now saying things on cue, which, you know, again, this was a group of 3 and 4 and 5-year-olds, and I was like one of the 3-year-olds, only they spoke better Italian than I did. And I was finally getting in there, and it also gave me a glimpse into the importance of emotional satisfaction of being part of a group, which, you know, as an adult, I couldn't do as well in the American setting because I was always an adult, and even though I could get insight into their world, getting this emotional feeling of being part of a group was not the same as that I got in Italy.
And through you, they could, I think, feel a sense of compassion and a sense of confidence.
Right.
They spoke the language, and Bill, we're happy to help you. You're our big American friend.
Yeah, and then they got interested in, you know, then they got interested in English and wanted me to you know, translate certain words from Italian to English, and had that curiosity about the language that was always interesting. But they always enjoyed teasing me, and that was not only because I didn't have the language, but that's very much a cultural kind of thing in Italy, to kind of tease people and joke around with people. And they especially liked this idea that they could tease an adult. And I was a good sport about it. And over time, the Italian did get better. But still, they always were in a situation where they could sort of tease me a little bit about my accent and about the language.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign County on line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Very interesting conversation and experience, I believe. Years ago, Iona and Peter Opie in England set about collecting children's games. And one of the things that they observed was that there were sort of age differences in games. And when you were a certain age, you would play one game, and you got a year older, you'd play a different game or a different set of games. And that seems to lead to the conclusion that maybe as kids get older, they begin to separate out by age, and that your 3, 4, and 5-year-olds may end up going different ways at a later age. Do you pick any of that up as differences between the younger children, or does it happen at an older age, as the Opies might suspect?
The Opies work is really fantastic because it was some of the earliest work.
It's wonderful work.
Yeah, of course, they're folklorists, and I'm a sociologist, so they were interested in documenting and describing the existence of these various games. And again, they were the first to give us a notion that there is a childhood culture and document this aspect of it in terms of children's play and games. And I think you're right about the age sort of thing, that, and some of that is a contribution here. I'm talking more of a sociologist in how we organize the lives of children. And in most societies, especially in the United States, we age grade children mainly by schooling. So children are often segregated by age. And also, as I kind of discussed earlier, when children get a little older, they're more reflective of their relationships with each other. And they realize that they like some children, and the things that some children do are maybe the kind of games they play better than other children. And therefore, the peer culture becomes more differentiated. When I followed children from preschool all the way through elementary school in Italy, I found that in the younger group, when they were in preschool, there were a few kids that kind of stood out as leaders, but all the kids kind of played together. When they got to elementary school, they began to divide up a little bit into friendship groups and chose friends in terms of these kinds of preferences for activities. You saw breakdowns by gender, of course, and that's something that we often see, that the girls and prefer one kind, certain kinds of activities that are often different from boys. There are some games, though, that sometimes can bring boys and girls together. But I think you're right about that in terms of this development of differences in preference for games, preference for different friends, and so on. Another thing I would point out, though, is that children are constantly kind of improvising these games. I would find one year that they're playing a certain kind of game a lot with each other, and then I go back and I find that they're playing a variant of that game that they themselves have created. It's still, the game still has the same structure, but now they've added new dimensions to it. So this shows children's agency, and I think that the Opies found this as well in the different kind of varieties of the same game. Some would have the same structures, but there would be differences. Because, again, children embellish and extend games they've created in this way. And again, that's something that I think that we need to pay more attention to, and we often overlook the fact that children are very active in the creation of these games and activities.
Well, thank you for very interesting.
Yes, very. Thank you for the question and the comment.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
I'm a mother of a child with disabilities. He has autism and he's mentally handicapped. And I was wondering if in any of your research, did you draw kids with disabilities? Were they a factor at all in your grouping?
Yes, in a couple of my studies, later studies in Italy, in one of my first studies in the United States, there was a child who, it was unclear to me exactly what the problem was. He was clearly hyperactive. And that child was removed from the preschool at the parents' decision, and was having a hard time being accepted into the group. But he was only there for about 3 weeks. When I got to Italy, however, in one of the groups I studied, there was a boy who I would say was mildly autistic. He was very much accepted into the group, but he often played alone. But the other kids saw him. Now, one of the reasons for this is that in Italy, children stay together in the same group through all the years of preschool, from the time they're 3 to 5, with the same teachers. So the groups have very strong bonds. So he was very much accepted into the group, although he clearly wasn't as much of a participant as the other children because of his autism. But he still participated in certain activities, and the children were very concerned that he be involved, especially in more formal activities, and that he be a part of the group. And the nice thing about this, when he went on to elementary school, he seemed to really show some improvement. When it was in preschool, he would seldom draw my attention to something that he accomplished, or if he made a drawing or something, he would just do the drawing but not talk about it. And when they went to elementary school, I was there with them until December. I had followed them, and then I came back, and when I came back, he grabbed my hand and took me around and showed me all the things that he had made and done they'd been there. So I felt so good about that. Also, in one of the groups I studied, they joined 4 first-grade classes, so then I had 80 kids instead of 18. And in one of the other classes that I then became a part of, there was a girl with Down syndrome, and she was a very active member of the group because, of course, their personalities with Down's syndrome are often that they're very social and so on. And she loved to talk and debate with both the kids and the teachers. And she was a very active member of the group. And I just felt that this idea of they call this mainstreaming in the United States, but mainstreaming kids in this way is important. But it's so important, again, when the kids stay together and have this such strong group identity, And that continued in elementary school in Italy, too. They stay in the same group through all their 5 years of elementary school. So these kids, I think, have more of a chance of becoming part of the group and being accepted. But, of course, it does depend upon the severity of the disability.
Great. Well, that's what I'm finding so far. Was
great.
Setting a peer group for him as he went into the elementary school has worked out socially.
Great.
I'm a little scared about middle school. But I was
yes, middle school can be tougher because then sometimes kids are, you know, more likely to be teased and so on. But, you know, we hear more negative things about middle school and adolescence. There are also kids that will stick up and stand up for kids that, you know, are being teased, are not being treated the way they should. And those are the kind of kids you want to identify for your child, and and make sure that the teachers realize that these kids are doing that, and you know, provide encouragement for them.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, one of the things that I was very moved by, you talk about strong bonds with these Italian school children. At one point in the book, you talk about an Italian girl who asked very seriously and earnestly, "Bill, will you be with us through high school?"
Yeah.
I love that.
Well, that was in first grade, you know, and that was I think about a month after we started first grade. And, you know, I didn't know, you know, how long this study was going to go on. I thought it was going to end in December. And when she asked that, of course, you know, I laughed, and the teacher laughed, and we said, "We'll have to see." But then I did stay with them until they finished elementary school, and then there is a group from the preschool, and she's one of them that I continued to interview, and I interviewed her and her parents when she was in her second year of middle school, and I'm planning to do one more interview next year of that group when they're in high school. So, and we also send letters back and forth, and I just this year sent them a letter telling them about things going on, and they write back, and some of the kids send me messages on the internet and so on. So with these kids, it looks like it's not going to stop ever completely, maybe research-wise, but friendship-wise, it's something that's going to continue for a long time, I think.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you as a result of your relating that story was how do kids think and or feel about saying goodbye to friends at, let's say, at the end of the school year, or about, you know, if they have to move away, having to say goodbye?
Yeah, when I studied this group when they finished preschool, and we did interviews with them and their parents, they were concerned about the parents a little more were concerned about, you know, which class they were going to be in when they got to first grade. And the kids, on the other hand, it was kind of a virtual problem. If they weren't in the same group as some of their friends, they would deal with that when they got to first grade. There was talk in the class about the three or four kids who were going to another school, and there was a certain degree of sadness. And these kids actually made the visit to the elementary school where most of the kids were going, even though they were going to another school. And there was a feeling and a kind of sadness about that, but kind of also an acceptance of that as something that happens when you move on. And I think for adults, for the parents, it was a little harder, and they were really more worried about it emotionally than the children who, again, it was something that they were concerned about, but also they sort of had this confidence that you make new friends, and there are ways, of course, that you can try to maintain these friendships, but it can be difficult, and it is sad, and most kids aren't going to be able, you know, if you have a friend who you were separated from when you're, you know, in the first or second grade or something like that, the chances of are younger. The chances of getting back together are usually pretty rare. When children are getting a little older now, toward the end of the elementary school years or into middle school, sometimes they can keep in touch and do keep in touch through their families, or they write to one another. And now, of course, kids are so accomplished with the technology and the internet that they can use that to keep friendships and so on. So you may see more of friendships maintained that, you know, have lasted into those later elementary school years. But the early ones sometimes, you know, they're gone, and it's sad for the kids, but they adjust and they make new friends and they move on.
Mm. Well, we have to say goodbye now because we've used up the time. Sorry to say, we have
to say
goodbye.
Yeah, it's gone very fast.
Professor Corsaro, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, I've really enjoyed talking with you.
William Corsaro is a professor of sociology at Indiana University. He is the author of We're Friends, Right? Inside Kids Culture. The book is published by the Joseph Henry Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. And settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's find out what happened today on the board.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange this afternoon, we'll get you those numbers in just a bit. But on the board, futures did finish the day higher in the August and through the May contracts of the beans. The July, which expired today, had a rough day, went off 48.5 cents lower. We'll get more get to those numbers in just a bit. The wheat and the corn finished a bit higher for the day as well. July futures now. 339.5 in the wheat pit for the high, the low at 332. A settlement price there at 337. They were up 4 cents. September futures 347 on the high, the low at 337.5. Settled 345, up 5.5. And the December contract 360, the high, the low at 350.5. Settled 357.75, up 5.25. March futures in the wheat pit 370.5, the high, the low at 362.5. Settled 368, up 4.75. In May, 373.5 high, low at 370.5. Settlement price there at 371.5. Finished the day 5 cents higher. July corn 244.25, the high, the low at 241, settled 242, up 0.25 on the day. September futures 247.75, the high, the low at 244, settled 246.5, finished up 1.75 on the day. December futures now 256, the high, the low at 251, settled 254, up 2.25. And the March contract 263.25, high, low at 258.75, a settlement price at 261.5. Up 2 cents for the day. May futures in the corn pit 269.25, the high, the low at 265.25, settled 267.25, up 2.25, and the July 272.75 high, low at 268.5, settled 270.5, up 2 cents for the day. September futures 269, the high, low at 267, settled 267.5. They were a penny higher in December futures in the corn pit 265, the high, the low at 263, settled 263.25. Unchanged on the day. September oats 139.75, the high, the low at 136.5, settled at 137.5, and they were up 2 cents for the day. From the soy complex now, the nearby beans July contract expired today at the noon hour, 890 the high, the low at 840, settled 862.5, and they were off 48.5 cents by the time they went off the board. Your lead option now is the August contract, 785, the high, the low at 756, settled 780.75. They were up 13.25 on the day. September beans, 682 the high, the low at 653.5, settlement price at 681.5, up 25 cents. And the noves, 669 the high, the low at 639. November beans settled 27 cents higher at 668.25. Once again, they were up 27 cents. The traders at the Chicago Board of Trade saying, hey, we need to build a little more weather preen into this market. It just got too low for them. January beans 672, the high, the low at 648, settled 672, up 26.5 cents. And the March futures 674, the high, the low at 652, settled 674, up 24 cents. May beans 660, the high, the low at 652.25, settled at 669, up 22 cents. Don't forget, we'll talk to Paul Cooley in about 10 minutes about the marketplace. Join us then during the closing market report. July bean meal 293, the high, the low at 280, settled 285. They were down 16.30 for the day, and the August bean meal 270.80, the high, the low at 259.20, and settled at 269 even. They were up 3 even. July bean oil 26.70, the high, the low at 26.25, settled 26.45, down 45. And the August oil 26.49, the high, the low at 26.03, settled 26.43, and they were up 10 for the, rather up 1 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. August feeder cattle, today's high 113.05. The low 110.75, the settlement 111.62.5, that down 190. September 111.80, the high 109.60, the low 110.50, the settlement that down 150. October feeder cattle, 108.50 the high, the low 106.75, the settlement 107.82 and a half, that down 127 and a half. July live cattle, 85 even the high, 84.50 the low, 84.50 the settlement, that down 185. August live cattle, 84.50 the high, 83.12 and a half the low, the settlement 84.42 and a half, up 52 and a half. October live cattle, 87.30 the high, 85.72 and a half the low, the settlement 87.27 and a half, finishing up 52 and a half. July lean hog, 79.60 the high, 79.25 the low, 79.42 and a half the final price, that up 47 and a half. August lean hog, 76.70 the high, 75.25 the low, 75.65 the settlement, that up 15. October lean hog, 67.45 the high, 66.65 the low, the settlement 67.35, that up 52 and a half. December lean hog, 62.80 the high, the low 61.80, 62.77 and a half the settlement, that up 77 and a half. And July bellies finished up as well today. 115.80 the high, 114.40 the low, 114.95 the settlement, that up 42 and a half. The Dow now down 50 points at 10,197, the NASDAQ off 18 at 1914, the S&P 500 down 5 at 1111.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Kathy Cooper from St. Clair Shores, Michigan writes, Dear Dr. Science, what is the difference between electromagnetism and animal magnetism? When I kiss my boyfriend, which phenomenon causes our lips to stick together?
Animal magnetism is a furry, damp form of electromagnetism. Unlike its sleek counterpart, animal magnetism needs to be fed and cared for to be effective. Electromagnets can be made permanent, but animal magnetism is as changeable as animals, which partially explains current divorce rates. What you and your boyfriend have been noticing in your lip adhesion probably has more to do with naturally occurring mouth Velcro than magnetism. If you notice the phenomenon more in winter months, it may be the same thing as getting your lips stuck to a cold swing set or an outdoor water faucet. In either case, carefully add crazy glue and then pull apart quickly.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
To order the Dr. Science book kit with new hardback book, best of series tape, and honorary master's degree, $27.95, call 800-989-DUCK.
It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. You'll also find us on the World Wide Web at WILL.UIUC.edu. Jason Croft is our technical director today. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson.